counterspin.org. David Turnbull, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
It is Monday, January 30th, 5:30 p.m. Talking about practice, we'll start momentarily. Thank you for listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, California. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We want to take a quick second to shout out a sponsor, and then we'll get into the show. Talking About Practice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Red Hot Metal, metalwork of all kinds, industrial to artistic, now offering tools for the Boroglass artists. They can be reached at 530-342-1970 or at redhotmetal.net. So thank you, Red Hot Metal. We appreciate it.
You got through that one with no problems.
Yeah, well, it didn't have sutraceuticals.
Nutraceuticals.
As one of the words. But yes, Chico's only locally produced sports talk show starts right now.
We talking about practice. Not a game. Talking about practice. It's easy to sum it up when you just talk about practice. I mean, listen, we talking about practice. I mean, how silly is that, man? We talking about practice. We talking about practice, man.
This is indeed Talking About Practice. Your man Jarrell Gilbert alongside Noobs, Derek Isumaki. What's going on, fellas?
Yo.
So, we're going to talk about sports and all that stuff. No football this weekend. Well,
no Pro Bowl parties, man. Come on, those were lit last night.
I did think that was funny when you hit me up and you're like, so what's up? You're not hosting a Pro Bowl party? Viewing party? I did not. So I guess we could talk about the Pro Bowl a little later for about...
I didn't watch it, so...
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah, okay, okay, there you go. So it's not on the table anymore.
There's your hot takes on the Pro Bowl. We'll get to some NBA news here in a little bit. Steve Kerr had some interesting comments. We'll talk about the Super Bowl. Obviously, that's starting next week, so we'll talk about that briefly as well. But before we really get into the nuts and bolts of the show, I wanted to take a second just to acknowledge what I stayed up for late on Friday night, and that was Venus and Serena Williams facing off in the Australian Open Grand Slam final.
That was a terrible Australian. I couldn't even do that. No, that's land down under was trying. What I was trying to go for with the proper audience.
People know where down, Australia is.
Down, yeah. Slip on the ball, babe. Yeah. That's still terrible. I'm not doing it anymore.
Completely unhelpful as well. Thank you. Anyway, they faced off in the Grand Slam final in the Australian Open. Serena ended up eventually winning. But the reason I just wanted to bring it up is it's rare that I'll stay up till, you know, 1 in the morning to watch tennis of all sports. But, you know, this matchup that would mean so much may most likely will never happen again. And so I wanted to witness it live. I knew it was going to be history. And I just think what these girls have done in their careers, who they've become and what they've had to overcome to get to where they are is just a truly great American sports story. I obviously don't want to rehash their whole lives right now. I just want to acknowledge, you know, two girls grew up in Compton. their father basically put them on a tennis court when they were 3 and 4 respectively. And now they have grown into a point where I think it's fair to call Serena Williams an icon for women's sports. And I just think in general, just an absolute icon, the way she's kind of transcended sports and gone into other things, pop culture and so on and so forth. And Venus, man, I mean, she, I remember when she came in, I was a kid, but it was like, this is the next big thing in sports. And even more so, the impact those two girls had on their sport and beyond that, it's a truly incredible story. Serena ended up winning her 23rd Grand Slam title, is that correct?
Which I think so, yeah. Broke the tie with Steffi Graf,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, right. And so it's, you know, I don't want to get into is she the greatest female athlete of all time and all that stuff, because I think in sports often that's where we go is where does this rank all time,
right.
Instead of just being able to
enjoy the moment.
She's a great athlete, and I believe she's 35 or 30. I think she's 35, and Venus is 36,
yeah.
Which in tennis, that's crazy because most tennis players, I mean.
See, I'm not a tennis player, and I've never really played tennis before that much, so I don't really kind of truly comprehend what it's like, but that's what they've been saying all this time, is that for what they are, the age that they're at, they're ancient for tennis players.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's crazy, because you had some of these situations earlier with, like, Tracy Austin, Jennifer Capriati. These girls were getting burnt out by the time they were 19, 20 years old.
Right.
You know what I mean? You turn pro at 13, 14.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
It's just amazing that 21 years later, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and how about what, like... We were in a time warp in the Aussie Open this year. We had a Rafael Nadal Federer final.
Yeah.
That was actually a great game. Like, I had the, I guess you could say I'm kind of lucky working at a bar where I get off super late, where, like, the Aussie Open was getting on as I was closing up. So I had him on both times as I was closing up. And I actually got a chance to watch him. But the guys' game, I mean, I didn't get as much a chance to watch the Venus and Serena, but. Rafa and Federer, that was an awesome match. It was great. Yeah. Like, it was back and forth, like, legitimately the entire time. Like, each one was taking one set. He got one set. It was just, I mean, it's a classic battle for them. And, I mean, Federer, speaking of, like, another person that's great for that sport and what he's done.
Right.
I mean, again, 35 years old for him as well. And, I mean, it's awesome, but great for them. Like, it makes me feel like I need to get out and run more or something. You know, like,
it's great too to see him get one more, because he hadn't won one since 2012,
yeah,
which doesn't sound that long ago, but it's 5 years now,
considering the guy was winning like every single one,
yeah,
at,
I mean,
his
there
prime.
Was a stretch there where I think he won something like 11 out of 14 majors,
something,
you know,
like
what I mean?
That, yeah.
It was a streak there, 3-4 years, where he was absolutely unbeatable. And you know, he really didn't have any rival for a while, except for when Nadal came up, and obviously Nadal was super strong on clay, unbeatable, you know.
Yeah.
But then Nadal kind of broke through and was able to win on grass and on hard court. And so to see those guys go at it, and to see the Williams sisters have another final,
yeah, that was just
it was
great.
A total throwback, and it was a lot of fun. And you know, it took Djokovic getting knocked out early for this to happen or whatever.
Sure.
But you know, it's, I love it, you know, because I kind of thought we were in a situation where, like, he was never going to win again.
Right.
Not quite like Tiger, because Tiger has dealt with a lot, you know, in his personal life, injuries and stuff like that. So it's not really a good comparison. But as far as, like, guys that you could consider to be maybe the best of all time,
yeah,
getting one more major before they walk away, I think that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. And like I said, I mean, it's rare that I would make... That tennis makes appointment viewing in my home, right? I mean, if it's if any sport's on, pretty much I'll put it on, especially if I'm doing something else in the background. But this was one thing where I was actually hitting you up, like, yo, should we go out or whatever? And then I decided, like, after a few hours, you know what? Why don't I just stay home, watch some tennis?
Yeah.
This would be kind of cool. I forgot how long tennis matches are. So
they are a grind, man.
Oh, my God.
Be, yeah.
I was tired. I was exhausted watching them,
right.
You know?
It's like they have to be like 18,000 games just to get the match winner, I feel.
Yeah,
it's like, I don't know how many. I mean, granted, like the whole, I get the rules and the basic premise of it, but still.
I mean,
you got to be really physically fit to be able to do that. I think that's, you know, why you're saying people don't last that long, because you're like,
Yeah, and it's so awkward movements because it's side to side.
Side to side.
You know?
Often on harder surfaces, too.
No doubt.
So, you know, you're just putting an absolute
I've always wanted to walk on a clay court. I always thought those were so cool looking.
They're fun to play on, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
They are pretty cool.
Yeah, I was a tennis player growing up as a kid.
Oh, no kidding.
Okay, all right.
I've yet to play on grass. I would love
you're
to
such
do that.
A man of mystery.
Seriously,
you went to Alabama. It's like, oh, I've known you for like 3 years. It's the first I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Playing tennis. Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, no, I used to play, you know, tournaments, and it was NELTA, New England Lawn and Tennis Association.
Nice.
Yeah, back in the day, I was pretty good. But, yeah, I love it. And I love the Aussie Open as far as from a spectator's perspective because – like other than the U.S. Open, which is obviously, you know, in Flushing Meadows, New York, it's only 3 hours ahead of us. But like Wimbledon and the French are a little tough for me because I got to wake up at like 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Whereas the Aussie Open comes on at like 12:30 at night,
yeah.
Which for a night owl like me is
same. I
absolutely
thought it was super
in my
cool.
wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So I like the Aussie. It's fun. Plus the crowds are really raucous, more so than in London and in Paris because – I don't know. You kind of think of tennis as sort of a reserve thing.
Yeah,
but
I really
the Aussies,
don't like.
You know, they get their drink on. And,
yeah. Oh yeah.
You know,
they got several warnings in the first matchup between Serena and Venus.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
Yeah, the crowd just, got several.
All right,
warnings.
You having been a player, like how difficult would it be to serve with someone making noise?
Honestly, can't really speak to that because all my matches were played like. In an indoor,
okay.
There was no like
crowd around you.
Yeah, if my mom would be watching, but there was like a glass partition that separated the courts. Like it was like at a country club, you know, that kind of thing. Not a country club, but like a private racket club.
Sure,
you know. And so there wasn't anybody there.
Yeah.
So I've never played. Okay. Like I've played all my other sports, crowds, about loud crowds, but like. Tennis is just, for me, like growing up in juniors, I never had to experience that. So I think if it was like really silent and then somebody just shouted out right when you're about to do that.
Yeah.
I could see
like,
that.
Like, sorry, but if you have like a constant steady noise throughout the entire thing, like you just kind of get
different.
Used to
you
it.
Shut
yeah.
It out.
You should
like basketball.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's,
you never actually hear the crowd.
I've honestly hated like sports that do that. Like golf in particular, like just have the crowd go the entire time. Like, yeah, I would want to like hear some more like cheers and like start some chants right now. Yeah.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I think that would make it a lot more fun. But instead we're just like, because you're seeing two people hit a ball back and forth.
Yeah.
Spice it up a little bit. You
and
know?
I think the some of the younger players, I think like Nick Kyrgios, I think dudes like that probably would not have a problem with it.
Right.
You know, because sometimes you see him trying to fire the crowd up.
Yeah.
Which is kind of antithetical to, you know. But I mean, tennis is evolving. I mean, for a long time, all the men and the ladies, they all wore white.
Yeah.
You know, it's still kind of like that at Wimbledon.
I mean, isn't that the All England Club at England?
Well, for a while, like, that was the rule. And then, like, I know Serena started, you know, when
with
she was starting.
With that cat suit. My
God. I mean, she was doing her own fashion thing. And I feel like for a while, people were wearing colors at Wimbledon. But then, and I could be wrong about this, but I feel like it's gone back to all white.
I think it is.
And I don't know if that's just the players themselves, like, going back to respecting the rule or if.
I mean, they have so many other options, so many other tournaments where they can really just kind of go crazy, I feel. So, like, we'll maybe go white this time.
Right. And I think white, it's a classic look, especially because you don't see it that often anymore.
True.
Whereas,
sure.
like, guys used to wear that, or all the players used to wear that all the time. It was all white.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And now, so you got all these crazy colors and dudes wearing plaid and, you know what I mean? So, it's cool. You know, tennis is you know, it's like golf. It's very individualistic.
Yeah.
You know, except for doubles, obviously. So you kind of have that opportunity. It's all eyes on you. And so it kind of creates that opportunity for people like Serena to design their own clothing, which is cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, talking about her transcending just the game of tennis, I mean, she's like a fashion icon, too, I would argue. You know, and she's a beautiful woman, too, man. Mm-hmm. I look at her skin. I'm just like, wow. She's like glowing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Just I don't know why I thought of that, but you know what I mean.
You know
like
what,
her,
what?
She must no, like no. She must like moisturize for like 4 hours a day or something.
All that lotion.
You know what
man.
I mean? Seriously, like she's glowing. She's gorgeous, man.
Yeah, you know? No, and I just like I said, I get really tired of the where do they rank of all time. I just thought this would be kind of a fun story to talk about, just because it, you know, it was historical, and again, just what those sisters. Have done and meant to the community around them and for American tennis. There is a whole generation of tennis players that are up and coming that this is all they knew was Venus and Serena growing up.
No doubt.
And probably inspired them to play and So yeah, I just wanted to mention it, but let's move on. I did want to get to the Steve Kerr sound
real quick. I just want to make one last point. I love fact that she destroyed Sharapova in their head to head.
Yeah,
because it's like you have basically two like dichotomy, like two opposite ends of the spectrum. Maria was like, you know, catered to at the very youngest of ages, going to Nick Bollettieri's tennis school in Florida. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Rich Russian parents, like, you know what I mean? Where Serena and Venus were playing on cracked courts in Southern California, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Probably with used rackets at first, you know what I mean? Like, so the fact that, like, because tennis is such kind of a country club.
Absolutely.
Sort of rich kid sport. Mm-hmm. And so to see.
That's why I never played.
To see that happen was like, I don't know, I enjoyed that because Maria just kind of strikes me as the person who's just had privilege her whole life,
yep,
and opportunity, and so to see that happen, I thought it was cool. And now she's suspended for drug use, so.
Yeah, right,
so there's that.
Yeah, and she said she didn't know she was using.
Well, it was something that, yeah, it was one of those things where it's just like a football player. It's like it's some ingredient and something they sell at GNC.
Yeah.
So it's like these people think, you know, if I can buy it at GNC, then it's legit. But it's not. I mean, for us, it's okay.
I mean, you can get like testosterone like at GNC and whatnot.
Testosterone for sure.
Anyway,
You know, another thing too about the politics of the sport too is like Maria gets so many more endorsements than Serena does. You know what I mean? And arguably it could be because of the color of her skin. You know what I mean? Which is really unfortunate. We don't have to get into a whole, you know, discussion about that. But I'm happy for Serena. I'm glad that, like, she has gotten over that tie with Steffi.
Yeah.
Not to get into the whole greatest of all time thing again. But she stands alone, and I'm happy for her.
And it was really cool. One last thing. Promise we'll get off this topic. But it was cool that Michael Jordan sent her those shoes. Did you guys get to see that?
Yeah.
After the win, she was doing a post-match interview, and the ladies handed her this all-white box that said 23, the greatest, and she got two pairs of custom Jordans with a letter from Jordan, and, you know, because this was her 23rd win.
Right.
Yeah, it was, so I don't know.
That's dope.
That was pretty cool, and you could tell, like, she was pretty stoked about it, and how couldn't you be? You know, the greatest I just thought that was a really cool moment. But
it's
cool that, like, no matter how good you are, everybody's still kind of in awe of MJ.
Yeah,
it feels like.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like,
I mean, his name has become so much bigger than just who he is. You know, like this sneaker brand in particular is something that just, you know, it's a fashion statement right now. Especially now, it's super hot item. You know, sneakerheads are like, big people. It's mainstream at this point.
Yeah, they're still making Jordans.
Exactly.
I mean, they're not going to be making.
I got mine on right now.
Right, yeah, there you go. I mean, that's one of those that just transcends his career. Like, you're not going to have James Harden shoes being sold 20 years after he retires.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't think.
I mean, we don't know, but like,
from what it looks like.
Yeah, Jordan.
He's with Adidas. They will not be sold 20 years later.
No, but I mean, like, even like Magic Johnson's Converse.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I remember him and Larry Bird were on the Converse posters. And, you know, I just, you know, I mean, MJ is just kind of like head and shoulders above everybody else when it comes to that.
But his name will always be synonymous with greatness. I mean, what he was doing, he's the reason that, I don't know if he's the reason, but. At the same time that his star blew up, he was one of the first people to be able to be a brand in and of himself, and he didn't have to be affiliated with the Bulls or with a particular team. He became individually more powerful than the franchise he played for. And then you see the progression of that, where someone like LeBron now essentially dictates the terms of not only his deal, but deals around the league.
Especially on his team.
I mean, he just came out last week and, you know, said they needed a bleeping playmaker and all these things. And this kind of stuff previously didn't really happen because the owners and the coaches and GMs are the people in power, and those, we usually don't hear this spill out into the media where, get me a playmaker, you guys need to do a better job, you need to spend money. But then when you look at someone like LeBron, who has got to the place where he's gotten to, it's because people like Jordan laid the foundation. And what I think LeBron's business acumen is, I know it's well documented, but I don't think he gets enough credit for it. I mean, he's going to be the first billionaire athlete, which is just insanity.
Wait, MJ's not a billionaire?
Well, he would have been, and then he got divorced. Remember, we were talking about this last week. Yeah.
That's real quick to go from a billion to 500 million.
No, never. I won't get there again.
His Siri keeps jumping in on
the Trace Comas clubs.
I mean, you see the size of that guy's yacht, though. I mean, and he is the majority owner of the Hornets, right? I mean, he's got to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's doing well.
He's got to be getting back up to seven or however many figures a billion is.
I mean, I feel like if you're stretching 500 million versus a billion, like, it's a big jump, but, like, that's pins and needles, I feel, at that point in time. Like, it's just, that's just like another big jump.
Pins and needles?
Yeah. Like, comparatively so, for that person.
Fair
you know,
enough.
Is $500 million going to completely and utterly change that person's life who already has $500 million?
I agree. No.
I mean, it's like, yeah, I'm just like, it's $1 billion is nice. It's probably for, you know, makes him feel a little bit better about himself and a little bigger down there. But, you know, it's, you know, $500 million is a ton of money and you can do pretty well with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to just like, you know, kicking him while they're down.
All right. Can we get to the Steve Kerr sound now?
We shall, yeah. Wait, one more thing on Serena and Venus.
So Steve Kerr came out and talked about the quote-unquote Muslim ban that Trump just passed the executive order on. And I don't want to get so much into the politics on this because you can listen to about 30 other talk shows on KZFR that will be discussing that this week. So I do want to talk more about the sports angle about this, but I do think some context is helpful. Steve Kerr's father was killed January 18th of 1984 in Beirut during an assassination. So it was a terrorist act that killed his father. So that may help put into context some of what he's saying here. So let me go ahead and just roll this sound.
I would just say that someone who is whose family member was a victim of terrorism, having lost my father. If we're trying to combat terrorism by banishing people from coming to this country, really going against the principles of what our country is about and creating fear. It's the wrong way to go about it. If anything, we could be breeding anger and terror, and so I'm completely against what's happening. And it's shocking. And it's a horrible idea, and I'm really I feel for all the people who are affected. The families are being torn apart, and I worry in the big picture what this means to the security of the world. It's going about it completely opposite. You want to solve, you know, terror. You want to solve crime. It's not the way to do it.
So that was Steve Kerr speaking about the Muslim ban. As I mentioned, another point of context that might be helpful. His father, in fact, was a professor, and his life's work was to try and repair relations between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And so I think that context helps. But Steve Kerr has been one coach in the NBA, along with Popovich and Stan Van Gundy, that have been very outspoken in regards to their feelings about Trump and politics in general, but especially since Trump's come into office, they've been really outspoken. And I just kind of wanted to start there with, is this the first time you've both have heard this sound?
That clip, yeah, first time.
Yeah, I just wanted to get your initial takeaways from just hearing that, what I guess kind of goes through your mind.
I mean, I guess after hearing it, it's again a very polarizing issue right now, especially in this country where you have, more like I said, what is being labeled as a Muslim ban, and in reality, like a lot of people are talking about this situation where we don't know a whole lot about it, and it's not really even that a Muslim ban. It's a ban on countries that contain a lot of Muslims in there, and it's not even a ban on that. It's just like a hold on those countries for 120 days for a good number of them. And for one of the countries, indefinitely, for Syria. Seven countries are on that list, and there's some more that can be added. And it's not like they're banning them from coming in. They're just putting a hold so they can revamp the process. So I feel like a lot of people jump out to a lot of conclusions because we have a very leftist side media who's very much against what Trump is standing for. So you get these very polarizing, like, one-sided, these complete, you know, opposite sides of information because some people are for this person or not against that person. That's kind of how they shape their view. So when they see Trump, they automatically think that anything he's doing is bad, so we want to jump at that. And again, it's not really the case right now. I mean, the numbers of refugees or people that he's allowing in the country are still going to be very minimal, like comparable to what happened 3 or 4 years ago, you know, when Obama was in office. And it's not like an unprecedented thing to do to put this type of lean, I guess, or hold on allowing people to come into the country. It's happened before under the Obama administration. So I think people are kind of looking at this with a lot of eyes that are, again, I haven't read the actual order. I don't know what it exactly says. I've only read things of people who have talked about it or have maybe allegedly read it or not. So that's, I mean, I think we're just, it's initially happened, so there's a lot of emotion behind it, and that's kind of what I think is driving a lot of people's responses.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, because right now, it's like anything he does is automatically going to be looked through the lens of, you know, he's a bigot, you know, he's a racist, he's a xenophobe, and he may or may not be all of those things, but the one thing I would say is that you're correct that it is only on 7 countries. And I'm not saying only, because it is going to affect a lot of people. I mean, there's even like basketball players that like were getting held up in Toronto. So
yeah, Luol Deng can't fly with the team right now.
So, you know, I think at some point you have to like have some clarity and realize like, okay, this guy's obviously not a terrorist. But at the same time, the one thing I would say to Steve Kerr's point, and to your point real quick, Derek, I agree with it. Like, it's like no matter what happens, there's so much vitriol, especially coming from the media, that it's like there's not really a whole lot of clarity. There's not a whole lot of like talking on the other side. And I'm not defending this position. In fact, I would even go further and say that we've completely lost sight of what's going on, because 17, 18 of the hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, right. Okay. Again, in a country that's not on the list.
Saudi Arabia is a terrorist state, in my opinion. Okay, granted, I'm not an expert on world affairs.
Sure.
But I see what's going on. They're funding ISIS against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Okay, they're funding terrorists. Most of the hijackers, like 96% of those kids, were from Saudi Arabia. I don't care where they train, that's where they're from. There's tons of anti-American sentiment coming from Saudi Arabia. There's anti-American sentiment coming from Indonesia. We're not banning anybody from Indonesia, largest Muslim country in the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's 46 other countries that are Muslim majority. I just heard it on NPR coming down the hill.
Sure.
And it's like, I'm not a xenophobe, and I don't necessarily agree with it because I don't know how much it's actually going to help. But the one thing I would say, though, is you look at what's happening with Europe, and there has been quite a few instances of, you know, terrorism. And it all it takes is like that 0.1% of someone who's going to get radicalized. But the other thing I would say, too, is that to Steve Kerr's point about fostering fear and making like we're creating more jihadists and more radical people by, you know, kind of like dividing us between us and them.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so we're creating more of this. Another thing I would say, too, is that A lot of what's happening is it's second and third generation refugees. It's not even just the guys that are coming over that are fleeing war torn areas. What a lot of it is, they come in to say Paris or London or Brussels, and it's like second, third generation Muslim kids who are growing up in poor ghettos, right? And so they're like they're living in a Western society, but yet all the Western ideals of, you know, prosperity and freedom aren't like necessarily getting applied to them. Or, you know, it's just difficult through economic reasons, whatever. So I think that's another thing that we need to look at is not just who we take in and when do we take them in, but where do they go and what happens to them after they get here?
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because if we take in, you know, 65,000 refugees from Syria, like was proposed, you know, that's all well and good. But it's like if they come here and then there's no opportunity for them, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like they're talking about this town in Minnesota where they've like they're bringing a bunch of people in from Somalia, or at least they were.
Yeah.
You know, but they're also saying that all these people are fleeing, like the white people are fleeing because there's no jobs. So you bring in refugees to a place where there's already no jobs. Like, you know what I mean? What do you expect is going to happen 2 to 3 generations down the line? They're going to be living in poverty. And it's like, yeah, we're here in America, but we're not feeling it because this is not the land of opportunity, at least that it was promised. So I just, you know, it's a very tough issue. But getting back to real quick to Steve Kerr again about fostering fear and making it more of a thing. I really feel like we just need to, you know, withdraw from the Middle East completely and just let this whole thing cool down, because we're over there for cadmium and lithium and oil and all these reserves that are not underneath our soil. Mm. It's underneath their soil, okay? And, you know, Shell and Exxon and Mobil and all these companies, these tech companies that are like, basically, you know, the United States military is like doing the bidding of the corporate global elite. And we've got to back away from that, okay? And I'm not necessarily for opening up all these pipelines or whatever, but at the same time, we need to become energy independent, okay? We have enough reserves here.
Sure.
We can get the technologies going to get coal at least a little bit cleaner, hydroelectric. I mean, there's geothermal. I mean, there's energy just coming straight up out of the ground. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We've got a giant, you know, orb of fire that's, you know, 93. You know what I mean? Like, it's there. It's just, it's getting suppressed. And I feel like 10, 20, 30 years down the line, we would see a lot less terrorism if we were off of their land and we could just open up dialogue and trade and work out partnerships, because these people are not inherently violent. It is a very, very small section of this religion. Who, by the way, is a very beautiful religion. I mean, they're like so opening. Like, if someone comes to your house, knocks on the door, like, you have to let them in, feed them and bathe them and stuff. Like, what Christians are supposed to be doing.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Talk about doing. You know, and you have radicalized Christians too who blow up abortion clinics and stuff like that. So, this is not just an Islamic problem.
Nope.
But we are making it by our policies, our foreign policies, we are clearly making it worse.
I agree. Completely agree. This is FM 90.1 KZFR. Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Derek, we got a read, I believe.
That we do. Talking About Practice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by White Glove Chimney Sweeps, House of Fire and Thorn Tree. I'm sorry, House of Fire on Thorn Tree Drive in Chico. For millennia, humans have gathered around fire. It's in our DNA. White Glove Chimney provides a warm, safe, and inviting hearth in your home. The Lopi, FPX, and Avalon Health products create a beautiful and heartwarming gathering place located at 3128 Thorn Tree Drive in Chico, or visit us at whitegloveChimney.com. Ooh, I like how they use the word...
millennia?
No. Where did I just saw it? What you call a fireplace?
A hearth. Chimney?
A hearth. Yes.
Hearth.
Yeah.
Hearth. There we go.
Yeah.
All right.
Hearth. Yeah.
The things you like and dislike, like the things that stand out to you.
It's not something you don't hear that very often, that type of language.
The things that put a smile on your face are forever fascinating to me. I did want to, we'll get to some fun stuff here in a second, but I did think it was interesting, being that this is Super Bowl week. The Super Bowl is this Sunday, if you weren't aware. It'd be surprising if you listened to our show and you didn't know that, but... I did want to talk about, so basically there's 5 days of media access, I believe it is.
I'm not sure.
Something like that. Basically, the players have to sit around and...
we could have gotten...
I'm just here so I don't get fined.
Yeah, that was the famous Marshawn Lynch, who happens to just have done a special over in Houston, Scotland for Skittles, which if you haven't got a chance to check it out, I absolutely recommend you YouTube that. It's amazing. But this is the week where the players interact with the media. Pretty much anyone can apply for a media credential for this. And the NFL is pretty lenient on who they give them to this time of year. And the reason I bring this up is because Tom Brady is going to get a whole lot of Donald Trump questions this week. And I just wonder how that's going to go. And the reason I'm curious is because Tom Brady historically has been a non-polarizing guy when it comes to speaking up on political issues, social issues, what have you. We all know Belichick doesn't say anything but a few grunts, and we're looking forward to the next team. We're on to Cincinnati and wearing a hoodie and whatnot. And obviously, there's a relationship between them two and our president as well. And I'm just very curious on how this is going to go. And for me personally, I'll just get my take out of the way so we could just put it on the table and move on. I really wish that the people who do back Trump in sports that have made it known that they back Trump would just come out and say it and have it over with, because I understand to your point earlier about how much of our media is very liberal slanted, I suppose, or has a liberal agenda. So I totally understand there's a big segment of our population that might not feel comfortable if they have more conservative values coming out and saying them. But at the same time, I think that Tom Brady kind of brought this on himself. And what I mean is, Tom Brady's very careful. I mean, you look in his locker and he has his Gillette stuff promptly placed, sometimes an Uggs box over here, you know. So when he had the hat that said "Make America Great Again," it was clearly placed there for a purpose. He's not the type of person, or hasn't had a history of being kind of careless and just tossing it in his locker, you know. So it was obviously placed there for a reason, and now he's being asked questions about it. And to this point, he has not answered any of them. And I'm just curious to see how that goes. I'm wondering if you guys find that interesting at all, or if that's just something that's interesting to me and no one else.
I mean, I feel that supporting Trump nowadays is social suicide, I mean, in some nature. And that's what the media has made it out to be, with a lot of overreaction. Like, look what happened to Uber over this past weekend because they didn't cancel their fares. Like, they're still accepting fares during the power outage at JFK when taxi drivers didn't do it. The media got all on Uber and said, oh, they're supporters of Trump now and this idea. And then people started deleting their Uber's account because of something that they did just to kind of provide a service to the people. Sure. They even came out and said they weren't for the thing. They thought the legislative law, the executive order that came out, wasn't, you know, had a lot of problems with it. But still, people were throwing them under the bus because they supposedly supported Trump. And we see that all across the nation of like, oh, how dare you support Trump? Like, we look at people in sports in particular, like Sage Steele got thrown under the bus because she had her flight plans canceled because a lot of people had their whole lives kind of thrown about
LAX,
because
yeah.
of what happened at LAX, JFK. All these people got that, and they were saying, oh, how can you be so heartless? When even the people who were like the refugees and immigrants are trying to come over had their flights issues as well.
Sure.
So you see, when you come out and support Trump or anything that in any way, shape, or form resembles supporting Trump, you get thrown onto the bus, essentially. And it's kind of ridiculous. It's preposterous, I feel, in my eyes at least, to do that. I mean, you have people out there who try to claim if you, like a black guy in any way or shape or form, supports Trump, he's an Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
Or he's a mediocre Negro, as people had said on live news on CNN. And it's ridiculous. All you're doing is creating...
Jim Brown's mediocre?
Exactly. Yeah.
I like Steve Harvey. I mean, come on.
I mean, what you know when you try to like, it's like they're trying to build a bridge
shaming.
Of communication,
yeah.
And you're just saying, "Oh, shut that down," because you're supporting this guy. And like, I just feel that it's gone on to show that if you talk about him and try to support him, you're not going to go very far, at least in the media's eyes.
Dude, it's so refreshing to hear you say that because I thought I was like the only one over 30 that felt this way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I you know, it's not that I'm a supporter of the guy, but I have noticed that there is like a degree of fascism coming from the left where it's like you can't speak your mind.
Right.
And if you do, to your point, it's career suicide. I mean, can you imagine an actor coming out now and being like, yeah, I support Trump? He'd never work again.
I mean, there have been documents, like there's a book out there, Primetime Propaganda, where they forcibly push out conservatives in Hollywood. Like producers don't hire them. Like they will find in that process, like, oh, you don't have that way? And like when we come out and say like all these actors are so brave for coming out and speaking out against it at their award shows, it's like, how is that really brave? They're amongst people that agree the exact same, believe the exact same thing.
There's nothing.
You're not getting tomatoes thrown about you.
It would be brave if someone actually came out and was a supporter and actually spoke their mind.
You don't have to be a supporter or not. At least just say what the left is doing on that side. Like I said, it's a very fascist in nature.
Is.
When you don't agree with someone and you feel that violence is the only response to that, that's fascism.
And you have the woman who's trying to replace Debbie Wasserman Schultz at the DNC, and she basically said the other night, I don't know if you guys heard this, she said, my job is to shut white people up. I don't know if you guys heard this.
No.
Yeah. Look it up. Just Google shut white people up, and then she'll come up.
Wow.
And it's like, yeah, she gave a speech talking about how it's going to be her job to basically shame other whites who say, oh, I'm liberal, I'm a Democrat, I'm not racist or whatever. And she's basically saying, no, you've got privilege and you need to shut your mouth because there's all these other people who haven't had it and they need their turn. And that may well be true, that there has been a lot of underprivileged groups in this country. But at the same time, it's like to like now just say that white people need to just sit in the corner and not say anything, it's like pretty ridiculous. You know what I mean? And so this whole thing of like everybody blames Trump for being a fascist, and it's like the left is exhibiting all these characteristics of, you know, don't say anything. Be, you know,
be on our side.
Be on our side.
With us or against us.
Yeah, and if you're not on our side, then you're a bigot, you're a racist, you're a xenophobe, you're sexist, all these things. It's just like, it's just not fair, you know, because I feel like a lot of these people probably who may or may not have voted for him. I can't speak for Tom Brady, but like, it's possible that he just didn't like Hillary Clinton. I know a lot of people that weren't even for Trump necessarily, but because there's a lot of things about him that are just so horrible. You know, but but you know, the fact of the matter is that there was a lot of anti-Clinton sentiment out there because we had 25 years of her, you know, obstructing and being involved with all kinds of nefarious things, possibly even murder and genocide and just lying about simple stuff and, like, you know, covering up for her husband. And it's just like, so people were kind of sick of her, you know?
Yeah.
And
so,
you know, unfortunately we had these two absolutely horrendous choices. But, you know, to be honest with you, this is kind of what Democrats get for thwarting Bernie. Mm-hmm. You know, they messed up their own scene by not letting the organic groundswell of support for that candidate really come through.
Right.
I mean, they did everything they can to shutter that. You know what I mean? Because, and all she ran on was, it's my turn.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And people were like, whatever. So now this is what it is. And it's like, we're going to have 4 years of it at least, you know, maybe even eight. Because you think about most people win re-election if they run for it. I mean,
the incumbent always has that.
Has the advantage. Yeah. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. H.W. Bush was the only it was the last one that didn't win. And that was a unique situation because we had a three-way race with Ross Perot getting in there.
Splitting
the ever-important rich Texas oil tycoon.
I mean, also
demographic.
H.W. was also coming out saying, like, he actually would put taxes on people because, like, they needed the money. And, you know, people don't like hearing when you say you're going to have taxes, even though every president puts taxes on
right.
people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as the hat and the locker, though, it's like, from what I understood, they played golf together and, like, you know, Trump tried to push the hat on him and then it wound up in his locker and then now everybody's made this big deal out of it.
I mean, it was some time ago that it was in there.
That's what I'm saying. It was like last year. So why are we talking about it now? And the other thing, too, is that if he had had a stronger together hat in there, nobody would be giving him any guff.
No, you're absolutely right. I guess for where the question came from is I just wish that someone like Tom Brady, who has nothing to lose, that's why someone like
he has everything to lose. I mean, he's got products out there that he's representing. I mean, you think Uggs wants to have their guy be their supporter of Trump? Like, again,
what
it's a triple down effect with that.
Yeah, but
if I could just finish my point.
All right.
My point is, sure, he has great job security, unlike most people in America. That's why you hear someone like Steve Kerr, you hear someone like Greg Popovich coming out. Greg Popovich, his owner donated, you know, $500,000 or something to Trump's campaign, and Pop has come out and bashed Trump at every turn. And I think when you have great job security like a Tom Brady does, you have the ability to come out, and I understand that there and support whoever you want to support and say what you want to say and not worry about your job security. Because let's face facts, the end of the day, no player around the league, given the opportunity, if Tom Brady came out today and was like, look, I might not agree with everything he does, but that's my guy, we're golfing buddies, you know, I'm glad he's our president, I'm happy for him, whatever. I don't think anyone around the league is going to go, you know, some high touted free agent's going to say, oh, I don't want to go to New England. You know, they're a bunch of Trump supporters.
Right.
Like, dudes don't really care. That's the thing I love about sports is so many times in a locker room, everyone around has come from different varying backgrounds, has different political beliefs. And oftentimes that's where you get really good discourse about various social issues is in the locker room. And at the end of the day, most people don't really care what your political affiliation is when it comes to sport. If you can help me win, I don't care if you worship the devil. If you're a great quarterback, you know, and you can help me win, then I'll play with you, you know. So it's unfortunate that we live in a time, I guess is my greater point, we live in a time that someone like of Tom Brady's stature doesn't feel comfortable just coming out and say, yeah, that's my
but
buddy.
Maybe it's not that he doesn't feel comfortable. Maybe he just doesn't, like, feel the need to do so. Like, he doesn't have any moral obligation to come out and say, this is how I feel. It's like they're not asking the other 52 guys in the locker room, who did you support? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like he doesn't have to necessarily say anything. I don't know if it's necessarily fear. I just think that there's a a environment in New England where you just don't give a lot to the media.
Sure.
You know, when Bennett spoke out against the NFL, you know, like, and because it was against the NFL, I'm sure it got, you know, they let it go. But he was like the most outspoken New England Patriots player we've had in a long time.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and so I just think maybe it's one of those things where you just don't give the media anything because there's a war in New England against the media. You know what I mean? And it's been like that for a while. So I think that maybe is driving it more. And but as far as what you say about job security, you're absolutely right. Because even if he retires tomorrow or Monday morning, right, which he won't, but he's like, first of all, they're never getting rid of him until he becomes so decrepit that he clearly can't play. And then after that, he's made so much money that he'll never have to work again if he doesn't want to. And if he wants to go into politics or something like that, and he actually is like a hardcore Republican, then that's the way he's going to run it anyway. Right. You look at Curt Schilling right now. There's people who think that Hall of Fame voters are kind of like, you know, degrading his status because he's outspoken. You know, so
he's also a jerk, though.
He is, but that doesn't mean.
That's a bit of a difference.
I mean, there's a lot of jerks out there. So many people are jerks, and they still get
it. The guy's the greatest, like, one of the greatest postseason pitchers of all time. You look at his regular season numbers, they're pretty darn good. Like, in my opinion, Schill should be in there.
Oh, I agree with you.
But they're
going
to make him wait until the last possible moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
but I think.
I just don't like politics getting so intertwined with how good someone is.
Sure. But I do think some of what hurts Schilling much more affects Schilling than it does Bonds. But I think people, Bonds would be a lot closer to the 70% that he needs to get in had he not been a first-class jerk. I think that weighs into the way we vote, because this is it's baseball writers that vote for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And Bonds and Schilling are famously rude and off-putting towards reporters and journalists. And so I think that hurts. I think that hurts Schilling just – I don't know how much because, I mean, who do you think most of those baseball writers are? Many of them are conservative, older, white guys, you know? So they probably, many of them lean right, and so many of their political affiliations probably are in alignment. But Schilling is such a jerk to so many people that I can see why you would be hesitant if you're a writer. Even though that's not what you're supposed to be voting on, I could see why you'd be like, forget this guy. But anyway.
I mean, about him getting fired from ESPN, though. I mean, that's another thing where, like, ESPN is kind of, like, so far left these days where it's, you know, I mean, you can't even, like, you know, have your baseball analyst, like, even speak out, like, a little bit for fear of, like, getting – I mean, you want to talk about job security. That guy actually needs to work. I mean, he blew $40 million on a video game company that didn't work out, and I kind of laugh at that.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a lot of money.
It's a ton of money. I would never have invested that much money into something like that, especially when you have so many video game companies that are already established.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to start from the ground.
It's got to be something to break into. I mean, this isn't Atari.
New game console.
Yeah, this isn't 1983 where it's like it's all brand new.
Right,
I mean, everything's pretty much established.
Yeah.
So it's like I think that was kind of a dumb move on his part.
I really wonder what the pitch behind that was. Like, yo, chill. I got this game. Money.
It's called Curt Schilling's Baseball.
I love it.
He's like, I love it. Let's go. Here's all.
Here's my
cover. Bank codes.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I don't know. I think we've talked way too much politics on the show today, and it's been a bit depressing just because I think the biggest issue that we've all kind of talked to is we just haven't been able to have moderate debate in a long time.
Yeah.
It's the media shouting down the right oftentimes. When the various media outlets that do give more of a conservative perspective, such as Fox News, they're not really covering news either. They're just yelling their point of view. And then you go to MSNBC and they're just yelling their point of view. And everyone's yelling. No one's listening. And so I'm kind of tired of it. I want to do something that's kind of fun, gives us a few minutes to break. So you get your thoughts together on the things that are upsetting you.
They're always fresh in my mind.
So I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, you brought up the glorious idea of talking about what people in sports look like. Now, Dan Le Batard's show, they have their writer or their listeners are amazing. They tweet in suggestions all the time.
And ours are too, but you know.
Yeah, ours are too, but
they're not writing us like
we don't have you know 8 million listeners sending us in suggestions. No, we'll be.
We have 8 million listeners. They just don't send in suggestions.
Yeah, they don't tweet us.
You know you're out there, guys. We know it.
But this comes courtesy of ESPN Radio, the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gotts. This is Dan Le Batard and Stu Gotts talking to Tim Kirchen, giving them some of their people in sports looks like. This is a couple minutes. So we'll break. We'll let you guys enjoy this, and then we'll be back. So Derek can gripe about things in everyday life that bother him.
We all like it.
Like, looks like the crooked auto mechanic who says, I'll get right on it. Then 1 hour later, you check on him, and he's leaning against the vending machine eating a candy bar.
Well, Golic isn't crooked, but that's 5 out of 10.
Mike Trout looks like a World War II GI emerging from a foxhole soaked in glory after once again saving his overzealous but incompetent kid brother, Johnny Manziel.
That's good. That's a 7.
Chuck Pagano looks like Tony Sperano's friend from childhood that Tony has to reluctantly beat up for repeatedly failing to pay back a gambling debt. Bruce Arians and Mike Dunleavy Sr. are the two guys on lookout while Tony Sperano is beating up Chuck Pagano.
God, who does this? That's an 8.
All right. Jeff Fisher looks like the guy in a Lynyrd Skynyrd shirt shotgunning a beer on the infield of a NASCAR track.
I don't know, Jeff Fisher, that's pretty good. That's a 9.
Terry Collins looks like the guy who shows up at the Golden Girls house to pick up Blanche Devereaux for a date. That's good, man.
Excellent. Terry's only 66, but that's pretty good. That's an 8.
Yeah, that's really good. Paul Feinbaum looks like the human embodiment of the NCAA rule book.
Oh, God, so bad.
Let's move on.
That's Chip, a 9.
All right. That's a 9.
So bad.
That's a 9. Chipper Jones looks like the guy who asks you how you want your steak done, then gives the tongs a few test clicks and says, well, then medium rare it is, with a smirk.
No, he's way too cool for that. I'm going to give that a 4.
Brett Bielema looks like the guy who says, diet starts tomorrow, as he takes a giant bite out of a pulled pork sandwich.
Oh, God. I don't know him very well. That's a 5, but that's pretty specific.
All right. Yeah, it is very specific. And now, because you said that we were going after Jim Tomsula too much, we've only got one Jim Tomsula for you this week, okay? But we've got several Frank Vogels. So here is the Jim Tomsula one. He looks like the softball coach who isn't playing your daughter on Saturday because she missed practice.
Poor guy. I'm going to give that a 5 and see if we can get him off the list at all. Next week.
All right. Frank Vogel looks like the guy who shows up when the car dealership salesman says, I've got to go get my manager.
That's good. That's a 6.
Frank Vogel looks like the guy who keeps calling you to hang out, and you keep creating excuses not to go.
No, that's not good. That's a 4.
Right, we're going to get you on this one. Frank Vogel looks like the guy who lost his high-powered vice president job, but 2 weeks later is still afraid to tell his wife, so he keeps pretending to go to work.
Terrible. That's pretty good. That's a 7.
All right. So which is the best one, Feinbaum or Terry Collins? Which is the best one?
Well, I like Paul Feinbaum, but that's probably the best one.
All right. Thank you, Tim. We'll talk to you again next week, sir.
Okay.
Good times to be had there.
Oh, yeah. Man.
I just wanted to do that. We're break up the show a little bit. We're going heavy on the politics.
Honestly, I hope most of the people know who those people were because...
Yeah, it's kind of truly, a visual medium if you don't know what they look like. But still, the descriptions are so fun that you can
You can just laugh at it.
Yeah.
With the...
Oops. Oh, that came in hot. Sorry.
All right.
My bad.
Sorry, people.
Well, are you ready for some grinds your gears?
I always am. I don't know if you guys are, but it doesn't matter because we're going to start grinding away right now, people. Okay, so first one of what really grinds my gears. People that hate the word moist. Like, that really gets annoying to me, that you really get physically and utterly ill when people say the word moist. I hope there are people in the car listening right now and hearing me the word say moist and get mad because it's a ridiculous thing to get mad at. I don't know if any of you guys are privy to the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I hope we are in a class of people that do know this movie, because it is a fantastic movie. Granted, Monty Python is hilarious. But these are the knights that say knee. Simple word gets you to flinch, and you just start saying, oh no, I can't take it because you're saying the word moist. Get over it, people. There are a lot worse problems out in the world than just saying words that hurt your ears.
All right, that was very weird.
Moist, don't...
really grinds my gears.
Go ahead.
This is one that I've recently come across. Rings as acceptable form of fashion on men, if you're not, other than people that are married. A wedding ring on a man is fine. But any other time a guy has a ring on, that's a no-go for me. I just don't understand how, like, a guy can do that. It seems so uncomfortable to wear a ring to begin with. I don't know why ladies do it on so many fingers. I feel like it just constricts your movement. And you never know when you have to put your dukes up and start fighting someone. And, like, you might think the ring might come in handy. But I really think your finger's going to say, no, I shouldn't have this metal band wrapped around it as I punch someone in the face. So, no rings on hands, guys, unless you're married.
I think that's respect an advantage though. In a fight, don't you?
I don't think people wear brass knuckles.
Yeah.
Okay, that's different. That's a brass knuckle. It's like wrapping around the entire thing. It's like a one big struggle. This is one ring that's like on one finger. And like, I feel like, I don't know. I've never punched someone with a ring on because I don't wear rings, clearly, obviously. Okay. But again, fight normally. That's cheating, then, we'll say. Okay?
You know what really grinds my gears?
Oh, this one really gets me. This is probably one of my biggest grinds. Escalators. I utterly, completely despise escalators with a passion. Elevators, for that matter, too, if you're only going up one flight of stairs. Elevators are only acceptable for people who obviously need them and people who are going up two or more flights. Escalators are, if you're going up one flight of stairs and there's no other option, that's the only way I'm taking an escalator. If there are options for stairs, I'm taking the stairs no matter what. That's God's honest truth. You can look up and down in my life because I absolutely hate them that much. I think the fact that we are so lazy to walk up a flight of stairs just shows how bad of a society we've become right now. Look who is our president right now. That's our laziness, people.
How do you feel about the people movers at airports and people just stand on?
Oh, that's the worst. Again, if you're on an escalator and you're choosing not to move up and down them with a brisker pace, you want to sit there and be taken up, go off to the side, right. Pick a side and stay there. Right. Because there are people out there who got places to go. In like going on that the walkway and you start rocking, gets you there a lot faster.
It does.
It's really does. Fast.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if you're really that lazy, like I get it. Travel's tiring. I've been there where I've had connecting flights and you're just like, oh, I gotta go down to that terminal. I'm just like,
I understand escalators like not wanting to climb, but yeah, not wanting to walk forward.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad. It's like, okay, so yeah. You were on a flight for 4 hours, you can still walk.
Right.
Your legs still work.
I mean, like, again, you that have legs. They're crazy. Great things yeah. out there.
Because they are great when there, you walk up. Like, yeah, and they're just right. standing there and their bags are all up in your way and you got your bags and you're trying to get behind them. And then they're, like, looking at you like you're crazy. They're like, well, why are you walking on the people mover? I'm like, because it gets me there twice as fast as normal walking.
I mean, you guys aren't
utilizing how cool this is.
I could run there right now and just look like a buffoon.
Right.
But no, I'm trying to use the technology to the best of its ability. And again,
I always had a fear on escalators when I was a kid. I would, like, jump over that last
I was always scared, too.
Yeah,
I was
me
afraid
too.
I'd get, like,
you get sucked in. Because yeah. those stairs are sharp, man.
Yeah.
You're going, if you, you go down
you
on there, you
make sure your shoelaces are tied on an escalator.
You're cutting. Oh, man, yeah.
Some kid must have, something terrible had to have happened. Because that's an irrational fear that all three of us share.
Right.
So there has to be an urban
legend. It's an urban
legend,
yeah.
It's kind of like, it's like the quicksand, I feel. You know, we all were like
or
terrified.
The kid who got his neck stuck in between the little springs on a trampoline.
Yeah. Like,
I don't
yeah.
think that actually ever happened.
Like how
it kind of ruined a lot of my trampoline experiences.
Oh, you're definitely like my jumping is very precautionary when I was jumping up and down because I was like I was scared of a foot falling in there or anything. Yeah, that's terrible series, man. Yeah, I mean I can go more if you'd like me to. If you
well,
need another
if you
one.
Want, I mean it's up to you. We have 2 minutes left. I kind of wanted to get to
we'll
some quick them. Super Bowl.
It's a lot for people to soak in there.
Yeah. I got three right
so,
there.
So in review,
don't get. People upset that say about saying moist.
That saying moist. Right. Again, it's not the. I understand if you don't. Maybe you don't want to use it in your vernacular. Fine, don't use it. But don't get mad at people for using it. Escalators and rings on fingers if you're not married for men.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Super Bowl predictions. Noobs, let's start with you.
Oh, God. I've been wrestling with this one for a while because obviously, if you've listened to the show before, you probably realize that I'm a Patriots fan. I am a little. Like, I don't know. I don't want to go too far on this, but. Part of me wants to put a little money on Atlanta just so if the Patriots lose, at least I can make some money off
of
it.
I know the feeling.
You know? But at the same time, I don't want to be conflicted on Sunday afternoon. I am going to stick with my prediction. I think it's going to be high scoring.
Mm-hmm.
I think both teams will be in the mid-30s. So I'm just going to throw it out there. I can't bet against my boys. So I'm going to say 35-31 New England.
Oh, okay.
We are talking high. Okay. I mean, like I said, again, wow. It really is almost like a toss-up, I feel, because, granted, New England has the prestige. They have the name. They've been there before. Atlanta, as Giroux has always said, don't trust Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yep. They have so many issues that Giroux loves to bring up.
Yep.
And... but a part of me, I would love to see Atlanta win. I think that would just be awesome for that franchise, for Matt Ryan too. I mean, Julio Jones is a freak of nature that I think deserves some top quality rewards.
Yep.
And so I'm gonna be betting with my heart on this one. I'm gonna say Atlanta, and I'm gonna go 31-28.
Nice. Yeah, I can't go all season long and say don't trust the Falcons and pick them in the Super Bowl.
that would be great, I feel.
It's just, no. I mean...
The irony.
The hypocrisy involved. So I'm going to go 37-35 New England.
Wow.
In a squeaker. And so that...
I mean, I hope we have any one
Atlanta
of these games.
Would cover there. New England wins the Super Bowl. No matter what happens, I think we're going to be treated to a great game. These are two obviously really good teams because they're in the Super Bowl. But I just think there's going to be a lot of points scored and, you know, hopefully get a close game and we'll see.
It should be close. I mean, you look at all New England's Super Bowls, even the ones they've lost. I think they're all decided by 3 points except for the one Giants one was four.
Yeah.
And both of those were four and the wins were all by three. So it's
all within one score.
It's all within one score. One thing, if there is any gamblers listening out there, there is a prop bet that says New England wins by 1 to 6 points.